It was quite a week. I had to catch a plane for Chicago and Michigan just after the windstorm, and we lost a lot of roof tiles. So I had to leave that with Kathy, get those all repaired. I kind of swept it out of the driveway, got in the car, and away we went. Kathy says, thanks. So, okay, there is a proxy card you can fill out if you're a member of the church. One of the rules we have in Sierra Madre Congregational Church is that we do need a quorum, and we need a minimum number of people voting. Otherwise, the motions cannot be passed. So if you can't make it, but you can fill out a proxy, that would be appreciated. No, I just like Tom was saying, I was watching the TV monitors, and they said, you know, weather is great all over the country except in Michigan. And that's where I was going, saw those big snowstorms there. But it was great. They had me stay in this bed and breakfast, but they didn't tell me I had to walk to everywhere on the campus in this blizzard. So that was fun. Reminded me of my upbringing in Canada. I mean, the locals are complaining because it was 10 above, and I says, this is nothing, you know, and put on a good front anyway. So then we come back home, and it starts to rain here, so our roof still isn't fixed. So, great week. But things really happened in Michigan. I was at a place called Hope College. And when I got there, they said, you know, we're a college that's proud of our cultural diversity and racial diversity. We have both the Vans and the Vanders attending this campus. there might have been three of us that didn't have blonde hair on the campus. So, and one of those unusual circumstances where I was one of the tallest people around. There was only two people I saw during that whole time that were taller than I was. But, so it's very culturally diverse. They say Vans and Vanders, that's it. They don't call the town Holland for nothing. So, it was good in that we had some excellent television and radio interviews. In fact, I understand some people in the class here heard it. So in travels outside of this area. I was on the Dick Staub show, which is carried across the country except in the Los Angeles area. So that's fun. I've been on his program before, but it's fun to be with him there in person in the studio. So the television shows will air later, but they're very good. And I was told by somebody from Grand Rapids that Beyond the Cosmos is back on the bestsellers list. So that was good news, too. And I got interviewed by somebody from the newspaper in Grand Rapids. The campus itself, they were doing a Veritas forum, which is interesting because it is a Christian campus. But as the president shared with me, he says, I'm new here in this campus. I'm evangelical, but the vast majority of the professors here are not. We have our doubts whether the majority of the professors here really are Christians. And we're trying to turn things around. So in that sense, it was very appropriate to have a Veritas forum there, you know, for the students and the faculty. And in spite of the blizzard conditions, that hall was packed out. It was about two-thirds campus people and one-third people from the differing cities around there. We even had people come in from Grand Rapids and Chicago. So in that sense, they were really pleased. And we really had a positive impact there on the faculty, so that was good. Q&A session lasted till about 11, so there was a good response there, and managed to get home all right. I was worried about whether I was going to make it here for class. Planes kept getting canceled. I remember going from Chicago to Grand Rapids. It took 11 hours to make that 27-minute flight. They just kept canceling flights, and they said, we got to plow the airport again, and I just kept plowing the airport, and eventually we were able to sneak in between snow plows. So it worked out. God was with us, so thanks for praying. What are we doing here in the class? As Tom announced, we're going through the book of Genesis. This is part two of our course on science and the Bible. We're now getting into the Bible passages itself, and it's appropriate that we spend a fair amount of time in the first chapter of Genesis. I've been reminding you of the treatment of the early church fathers. They referred to the 6 days of creation as the hexameron. And of all the points and passages of the Bible that the early church fathers chose to write about, this got the most attention. I mean, there's no other portion of Scripture that receives as much commentary from the early church fathers as the 6 days of creation. 2,000 pages of commentary total on just these few verses of one chapter. That's because the early church fathers understood how critical this first chapter was for the gospel and the Christian message in particular. If you read their commentaries, they all make a big deal about the fact that this is the first place and a very specific place in the Old Testament that deals with the Trinity. And it's one of the more powerful passages for communicating to Jews the truth of the Trinity. Kind of in the first and second century church setting, they saw this as a terrific tool for getting Jews from the Old Testament into the New Testament. So that probably is a large part of the reason for spending that much time in the chapter. But they also saw it as critical for reaching pagans and secularists throughout the Roman Empire, and that it really details who God is, what he is doing, and just how intimately he is involved in his creation, and therefore we should expect that he would likewise be desirous of an intimate relationship with every human being. So that was their reason for spending that much attention. Now, as we pointed out in previous classes here, the key to the sequence of creation events in Genesis 1, in my opinion, is to recognize that it does follow the scientific method, which is really no surprise since this is where the scientific method comes from. And the scientific method is really a disciplinary tool which says avoid interpretation until you first establish the frame of reference and the initial conditions. The Spirit of God moved over the surface of the waters, so we understand the events of the 6 days of creation from the perspective of an observer on the surface of the waters, below the cloud layer, not above the cloud layer. We looked at the first verse of Genesis. There the frame of reference was God up there in the heavens, but it moves down to the surface of the waters in that second verse, and it's critical that we spot that transfer of frame of reference from the universe down to the surface of planet Earth. The four initial conditions, I won't ask you to review it again, but it's dark on the surface of the waters, it's empty of life, unfit for life, and the water is everywhere upon the planet. And the last three Sundays, we've been looking at the events of the first and second creation days, where we note that rather than God creating, God lets things be. He uses the verb hayah rather than the verb bara that we see in Genesis 1:1. Let the light be, and then let waters be above the waters below, referring to liquid water below, and the water vapor and the liquid water in a form of rain above the surface of the waters, referring basically to God transforming the planet so that light can pass through this atmosphere. It started off opaque the first creation day. It is made translucent so that light can pass through. Translucent just like you see today. Light passes through the clouds, but you can't see anything beyond the clouds. And this is the condition up until the fourth creation day. And then in the second creation day, we have God establishing a water cycle so that water cycles from the atmosphere to the ocean back to the atmosphere, that being a requirement for what's going to be taking place on the third creation day. The third creation day, we have God forming continents and islands. In order for life to exist on those continents and islands, it's necessary that they be watered by water falling from the sky above, draining off those land masses into the oceans where they're evaporated, and we start the cycle over again. So that's the first and second creation days, and as we pointed out in previous weeks, Genesis 1 is not the only passage that deals with the specifics of the first and second creation days. We find many other references to the creation story elsewhere in Scripture. Moving into the third creation day, we have two events. God allowing the land masses to appear above the waters. So continents and islands now begin to form using the verb hayah. It doesn't say that God created the mountains or created the continents and islands. He says, let them be. Let these continents and islands appear above the surface of the waters. And then the second event of the third creation day, let the land produce plants, using the verb dasha. We'll focus a little bit on what that word means. Just to announce once again, Roger announced earlier that these little handouts are available, Word Studies in Genesis 1. If you didn't get yours, they're available on the table there. And this is a little tool that takes you through a standard English translation, puts numbers under the English words, then you turn a page, and you have dictionary definitions for each of the Hebrew words that are used in the original. The theme there, that although you don't need the Hebrew to understand the majesty and the glory of God and creation going through the first chapter of Genesis, if you want to nitpick the scientific details in order to witness specifically to people that are technologically trained in these matters, don't be shocked if you have to examine the original Hebrew and dig out exactly what the words mean in the original language. So that's why we're going to be making references to the Hebrew as we work our way through this, precisely what it means, because we live in a day and an age when we know enough about the record of nature that we can make these point-by-point comparisons, whereas people generations ago couldn't do it. But keep in mind, the prime message of the text is to communicate God's glory and power, personality, and care in creation. David. That's true. There are fewer words in the original than what you see in the English translation. This particular chapter may be an extreme example of that compared to other chapters that we find in Genesis. In fact, I would say, David, that that's kind of a pattern for the first 11 chapters, is that the English translations tend to be far more verbose than the original. Then once you get into the historical chapters for the story of Abraham and his family, you don't see that. Keep in mind that the Hebrew language is quite efficient in the way its verbs are set up for communicating narrative and history. And therefore, it's probably no surprise that that's kind of the dominant tenor of the Old Testament, that it does focus on narrative as opposed to the didactic teaching that we see in the Greek New Testament, because that kind of fits into the power of the Hebrew language. And once we realize that the biblical Hebrew has barely more than 3,000 words, whereas English has over 4 million, it's not really that surprising that we have a few more words in the English than we do the Hebrew. But it also means that where you have a paucity of words in the original and you're translating into English, interpretation comes into it. And Genesis 1 is one of the prime examples where the English translators are forced to interpret, to put their own spin on it, where they wouldn't be forced to do so in other passages of the Old Testament. I believe that some of the controversies we fight with concerning Genesis 1 flow out of that translation difficulty. Probably the most famous one of all would be the King James translating this repeated phrase about the evening and the morning. Trying to make it flow well into English, they wound up making a lot of interpretation, and the modern translations today use more words than what the King James translators use, and corrected what, in my opinion, is an interpretation error. Just to be specific on what we're talking about, in the King James Bible, when it refers to the evening and morning sentences, it translates it like so. The evening and the morning were the second day. But I think that's one reason why we have, coming out of the King James language church, this idea that the creation days of Genesis are 6 24-hour periods. What the original Hebrew says, I can read it to you in this New International Version, which does use a few more words to describe these. It says, and there was evening, and there was morning the second day, rather than the evening and the morning were the second day. There's a major difference. Now, you know, might seem trivial, but when we get into the issue of how long these creation days are, this is not a trivial matter anymore. And it is true that in the Hebrew, the verb hayah appears twice, not once. The King James translation makes it look like it appears only once. It also makes it look like the subject complement is tightly tied to the subject, when in fact it's not. The subject appears twice, the verb appears twice, and you got one dangling subject complement. And that leads someone reading Genesis to say, why did Moses choose, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, to write such a clumsy Hebrew sentence? And if you read the early church fathers, they picked up on this. They said there must be something in this. There must be some reason for this. Whereas when you look at the King James translation, you're reading it in the English, it's like you don't pick that up at all. And so that can lead you into some inappropriate interpretations. That's one example. But there are many others in Genesis 1 that we'll come up with later. Now, with respect to the third creation day, it says, and God said, let me move down, here it is. And God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let the dry ground appear. And it was so, and God called the dry ground land, and gathered the waters he called seas, and God saw that it was good. So we'll stop there. We'll look at the land-producing vegetation a little bit later. But this phrase, let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, let the dry ground appear, is repeated in three other creation accounts we find in Scripture. Psalm 33 refers to it. Psalm 104, the creation psalm, which reflects all of Genesis 1, refers to it in five verses. And then we have a reference, a short reference, in 2 Peter 3. So I'm just going to take you to those cross-references, then we'll examine exactly what the text is saying here about God gathering the waters to one place. First, let's go to Psalm 33:7. It says, God gathers the waters of the sea into jars. He puts the deep into storehouses. And if you look at what the word jars refers to, another one would be heaps or places or bowls or basins. So he gathers the waters of the sea, the ocean, into these jars, basins, heaps, etc., and puts the deep into these storehouses. Then Psalm 104, starting in verse 5, it says, he set the earth on its foundations, it can never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. This is referring to the time when the waters were covering the whole of the earth. In fact, it says in the next part of that verse, the waters stood above the mountains. But at your rebuke, the waters fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took to flight. They flowed over the mountains. They went down into the valleys to the place you assigned for them. You set a boundary they cannot cross. Never again will they cover the earth. As people have dug into this, this is not a reference to the global flood. You know, it's only been in this century that people have quoted Psalm 104 as a proof text for the global flood. Again, if you read the commentators of the Middle Ages, early church fathers, the post-Nicene writers, they were seeing this as a reference to Genesis 1. In fact, this entire psalm is obviously a reflection of Genesis chapter 1. So don't confuse this with a comment on the flood. It's got nothing to do with the flood. It's referring to the fact that the waters, the earth's surface, was covered totally with water in the beginning. And then the third creation day, we have these mountains appearing above the waters. Continents and islands show up for the first time. And we're told here that that's the way it's going to be until God accomplishes his purpose with the universe and the earth. Never again will these waters cover the whole surface of the earth. Maybe they never should have made that movie Waterworld, right? Scripture tells us that's not going to happen. Okay, 2 Peter 3, verse 5. They deliberately forgot that long ago by God's word the heavens existed and the earth was formed out of water and with water. So this is Peter commenting on the fact that we have the continents coming up out of the surface of the earth, which was covered with water all over. So again, some people look at this as a reference to the Genesis flood. The next one refers to it. The water, also the world of that time, was deluged and destroyed, and by the same word, the heavens and the earth reserved for fire, the day of judgment, etc. What is interesting here is it's referring to this event as a being of long ago, of ancient days. All right. Well, that's what the text is saying here. It's not talking about God creating continents or islands by fiat miracle. He's working through the natural processes so that these continents and islands would appear so that we could now have land life. I mean, you don't need the continents and the islands if all you're talking about is ocean life, but God's intent is that there would be land life. Keep in mind this first chapter is referring to a God preparing the earth for human beings. So, exactly how that happens, we've hinted a little bit about this last week. What we see taking place here on planet Earth is a combination of processes that work to produce continents and islands and also work to destroy continents and islands. So let's look at the sum total of processes. You have plate tectonics and volcanism, earthquakes and volcanoes, that will wrinkle the surface of the Earth. So what we're really talking about is a primordial Earth that is a very smooth crustal surface. But as it's subjected to plate tectonics and volcanism, that crustal surface begins to wrinkle. As it begins to wrinkle, continents and islands show up above the ocean. I mean, the ocean isn't going to be very deep. We're only talking a few miles deep. So you don't need a lot of wrinkling. You know, the Earth's about 8,000 miles across. So just the tiniest amount of wrinkling by plate tectonics and volcanism is required to get these islands and continents appearing above the surface of the waters. And this is a process that goes on to this very day. I mean, Hawaiian Islands are becoming bigger and bigger. It's the one state of the Union that's growing in land area with each passing year. And there's a mountain just below the big island of Hawaii that will become the next island. As that volcano keeps erupting, eventually it will pop up above the surface. If you want to start investing in real estate there, in about 2 million years, you should have a return on your investment. So, it's happening. But like the big island of Hawaii is growing in size by a few square miles every decade, the northernmost island where the volcanism has stopped, Kauai, is shrinking. And it's shrinking because of erosion. Wind and water erosion causes, you know, the land area to become less and less. In that sense, California is getting smaller because of erosion. But we also have plate tectonics, which causes it to get bigger. And so we got both processes going on here in California. We got some volcanoes here as well. So is California going to get bigger or is it going to get smaller? Well, most geophysicists believe that we're on the plus side rather than the minus side. So California is getting larger, but not at nearly the rate the Hawaiian Islands are. That's growing much more rapidly in size than California would be. But the plate tectonics has got a good chance of lasting a long time here in California. In fact, if you wait long enough, these San Gabriel Mountains will be the next Himalayas. You say, how long? Well, on the order of 10 million years, that ought to do it. We'll have the premier mountain climbing area in the world at that time. So you might want to start making some appropriate investments too. So now, both of these processes are variable. Now, we were talking last week about how the Earth was subjected to this miraculous collision by a Mars-sized object, and that allowed us to get the atmosphere that's necessary so that we can have water vapor in great abundance and yet not have huge quantities of methane and ammonia, and how we had to get rid of our primordial atmosphere because it was too heavy for life and wind up inheriting a much thinner atmosphere in its place. Well, one result of that collision was that the Earth was spun up in its rotation, having days as brief as 6 or 7 hours. But as the Moon has been spiraling away from the Earth and exerting tidal friction on the Earth, our rotation period has gradually been slowing down. Now, the rotation period of the Earth is the prime driver of erosion forces on our planet. The faster the planet rotates, the more wind and water erosion you will get. You also get some erosion from the tidal friction that the moon exerts on the Earth. But the moon is spiraling away from us, which means that tidal friction is getting smaller and smaller with each year that passes. And it's moving 6 centimeters a year away from us, so you might have noticed the tides are getting a little bit smaller with each passing year. No, you won't. It takes a few million years before you really notice. But over the long scale, that means that the forces of erosion are getting less and less here on planet Earth, which means that the mountain building should be stripping the erosion forces enormously, not quite, because the plate tectonics and volcanism is also subsiding with respect to time. There are many factors that are driving that volcanism and plate tectonics, but the biggest contributor would be radioactive decay from long-lived nuclides in the Earth's crust, primarily potassium-40, uranium-235, and uranium-238. Well, as that stuff decays, that means there's less and less heat coming from the Earth's crust to drive that volcanism and plate tectonics with each year that passes by. So over the last 4 billion years of the Earth's history, the volcanism and plate tectonics has been going down, and the erosion forces have also been going down. All right, what would we expect? Well, if you plug all the numbers in, what you would expect is that in the early part of the Earth's history, the volcanism and plate tectonics will considerably supersede the erosion forces. There are less continents to erode, for example. I mean, the bigger, the more continental land masses you have, the more seashore area or seashore mileage that you have, then the more stuff is going to erode. So when the continents and islands are small, that means the net erosion effects will be smaller than they would be today. And so as these continents and islands are building up, and they're starting off small, we would expect the volcanism and plate tectonics to supersede the erosion forces. And the bigger these continents get, then the more significant these erosion factors would become. Also, the placement of those continents is important because according to where they're placed, the islands and the continents, that will affect the tidal friction that you have. I mean, if you go to the surface of our planet right now, there's quite a bit of variance in the tidal energy that's released. My mother's side of the family comes from a region just a few miles from the Bay of Fundy. They have tides there that get as high as 50 feet. And it's such that the rivers that flow into the Bay of Fundy reverse twice a day. They flow the wrong way. The water goes uphill instead of going downhill. It's kind of fun to watch. I've been there and watched it happen, and they say you have to be careful if you're out there in the Bay of Fundy at low tide, because a man literally cannot run fast enough to get out of the water. If you're on horseback and you've got a good horse, you can beat the tides, but the tides run that fast. So, but that's unusual. Tides here in California are kind of tiny. Where I grew up in Vancouver, they were quite large. We had 15-foot tides. Now, here it's just a few feet. So where you place the continents is important. And this is significant because, you know, when the continents are all together, you're not going to get as much of that tidal energy being thrown upon the seashores as you would today when the continents are well separated, where you've got these peninsulas going down and islands where you can get a little more tidal interaction going, water being trapped where the tides can have a more significant effect. But what you would expect is that over the first billion years, the continents and the islands would build very rapidly. And when they get to be about 30% of the land area, or the 30% of the surface area of the planet, that's when the erosion forces catch up with the plate tectonics and volcanism, and they're roughly in balance. And over the past 3 billion years, they have been roughly in balance. Now, what's going to happen as things continue? Well, the moon is spiraling away. That means that the tidal friction is getting less and less. The rotation period is slowing down. But we would expect that the plate tectonics and the volcanism might get a head start. on the erosion forces, say, a billion years from now. Well, we're in that window of time where the plate tectonics and the volcanism roughly balances the erosion forces, and even though both are subsiding, they tend to be subsiding at roughly the same rate, keeping the continents about 30% compared to the total surface area of the planet. And I don't think it's any accident that that 30% ratio is ideal for getting the greatest diversity of life on the planet and getting the greatest biomass on the planet. 30% is the ideal ratio of continents to the total surface area of the planet. So that leads us to suggest that God very carefully fine-tuned the rate at which the Earth is slowing down on its rotation and the rate at which volcanism and plate tectonics is slowing down so that the two stay in balance. They say, does this maybe factor into eschatology? I think so. The Lord has got to come in a lot less than a billion years because things are going to go out of balance fairly soon. So, but we've already commented on that last week, how the plate tectonics and the volcanism factor into how efficiently carbon dioxide gets moved from the crust back to the atmosphere. And as that plate tectonics and volcanism continues to subside, we're not going to have an adequate recycling of carbon dioxide from the carbonates in the crust back to the atmosphere. And actually, that window is going to close a lot faster than this erosion and plate tectonics and volcanism getting out of balance. So in that sense, the Lord's got to come, I would guess, in fewer than a couple hundred million years. But, I mean, we've been through the book of Revelation. I really think we're looking at decades or a century, but not hundreds of millions of years. But if you want a hard and fast scientific window of closure on the return of the Lord, this would certainly be it. All right. So we have these continents forming, which is going to permit the land life to exist. And you might ask, is there any reference in the Bible to the fact that ocean life previously existed? Well, there's one that commentators point out, but it's not a strong one. This is Genesis 1:2, where it speaks about the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And the key there is what that verb hover means. And you can flip it over here in your little sheet. It's the verb rakaf, to brood over, to cherish, to vivify, to be tenderly affected, to be moved. Those are all the definitions you will see in the lexicon. However, the lexicon will point out to you that the last of those definitions, to move or to hover, is the predominant usage of that word in Hebrew literature. There's a possibility it could mean to bring to life, to vivify, and actually that's in the lexicons because of the fact that this particular word shows up only one other time in the Old Testament. It's in Deuteronomy, where it refers to a female eagle hovering over her eggs, and some commentators have looked at that and says, well, maybe that's a reference to the activity of that female eagle in trying to hatch her eggs and to bring them to life. But people who comment on the use of this word in Hebrew literature say it's so frequently and predominantly used to move or to hover that it's a bit of a stretch to say that Genesis 1:2 is an explicit reference to God creating life first in the oceans. It's certainly possible that you could read that into that verse, but it's simply a possibility. It's not fair to argue that it's a probability, much less that it's a certainty. So in that sense, you could say, well, maybe the Bible is simply silent on when God created life in the oceans. It might have been before the 6 days of creation. It might have been before the second day, the third day. Hey, it could have been any time previous to the fifth day, because explicit mention of life in the seas doesn't show up until the fifth creation day. But there it's referring to advanced sea life, the sea mammals, and the charettes, which themselves are fairly advanced mollusks on up. So really what would be fair to say is that the Bible is silent or relatively silent on the early life forms that he created in the oceans. We're really forced to rely upon the scientific evidence in this case, and that scientific evidence does tell us that the first life on Earth was marine life. Marine life was first, and it was here for a long time before we find any evidence for plant life, which kind of fits what we see here in Genesis 1. I mean, you've got the oceans for the first two creation days. There are no continents. There are no islands. And given that God is trying to maximize the bioresources for human beings, we would expect that he would create life as soon as possible. And therefore, we would interpret Genesis 1 as God creating life during those first two creation days, maybe even a bit before those first two creation days, so that human beings could benefit from the maximum biological resources, referring to coal, oil, gas, that kind of thing. But as far as explicit reference, it's not here in the text. And I'm not surprised that it's not. I mean, the text is focusing on the most significant miracles that God performed to prepare the planet for human beings. Most of us don't spend much of our time in the marine ecology of this planet. We spend our time on the continental land masses. We simply play on the beach, on the seashores. We don't go spending our lives in the deep oceans. So it's not surprising the text doesn't focus on that. Okay, moving into the second event of the third creation day, it refers to God producing plants on the land. It says, let the land produce. It doesn't even refer to God doing it. God's the author of all of this, of course. But it's simply the production of plants on the land. Now, I do want to spend a little bit of time here because this has been the subject of a lot of ridicule of Genesis as a scientifically accurate text, mostly because of what we see in the English translation. Let me read it to you in English. Then God said, let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it according to their various kinds. And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds, and God saw that it was good. Now, as I've read it there, you know, a modern English language reader, what comes to mind as you look at that text? I ask this question of my children. What do they think this text is talking about? Apple and cherry trees. Okay, that's kind of what hits you right away. Well, if you know anything about the fossil record, you realize that those kinds of plants show up really late in the fossil record. And this gives you the impression that we're talking about the earliest plants on planet Earth, and certainly they were not that advanced. But if you look at your little word study guide, you'll see that the Hebrew terms are much more generic than what seems to come across in most English translation. I mean, the word fruit conjures up the idea of peaches and cherries and apricots. But notice what the text says. It's making reference to seeds. Let the seed-bearing plants that bear fruit with seed in it. So it's talking about plants with seeds surrounded by some kind of fruit. Now, we're going to look at exactly what we have there in the original, but what we're going to see is it's referring to seed generically and fruit generically. The point being here, doesn't every plant that's ever existed here on planet Earth produce some kind of seed or embryo or zygote? That's one of the definitions of life. If it doesn't have that, it's not going to reproduce. So in that sense, you can say this is not a reference to apricots. It's a reference to all plants, all vegetation that has ever existed here on planet Earth, because every plant would have that as a characteristic. And the seed isn't going to germinate unless it's got some food. And so the fruits surrounding the seed would be simply referring to the food supply that's necessary to ensure that that plant would germinate. I mean, if you want reproduction, there's got to be a zygote. There's also got to be the possibility that that plant will get well enough established that it can make it so that it can reproduce. So in that sense, we'd also conclude this is generic to all plant life, not just apricots and oranges and peaches. Okay, what are these words? Well, there's three words here that we need to look at in the text. It's the word zera, and the word etz, and the word pere. And there's a typo there. That's not fod, that's food. Okay, we're looking at words number 11, 12, and 13 there. So we still need to fix that up there. The word for pere means food and or embryos produced by any living thing. Etz, any large plant containing a woody fiber. I've just done a study on this word for the next book I'm working on, and actually it would be referring not just to cellulose, but to any kind of chemical in a plant that's capable of providing some kind of stiffness or a stalk. Could even possibly refer to these multicellular filaments that are able to resist wave motions in the oceans. Anything that provides a degree of a structural strength, and it doesn't have to be a lot of structural strength, would be covered by that word. And this is what's translated into most English translations as trees. Again, you look at trees and you think of redwoods. But in the original Hebrew language, it could refer to celery, okay? And it could even refer to the seaweed. What do they call this stuff that has a... Yeah, kelp. Kelp would qualify under this word. Zera, this would be referring to the embryos or the seeds of any kind of plant. All life, not just plants but animals, would be described by beginning with some kind of embryo. So we see here in the original are really highly generic terms that could be used to refer to virtually all life certainly with respect to the fruit and the seeds, and much of plant life with reference to the, quote, wood, or the chemicals that provide some modicum of stiffness. Now, do plants like that indeed exist as far back in the fossil record as that we can measure plants? Indeed, they do. So, now there's no problem here with the fossil record. And, you know, we're in the third creation day anyway. We're not necessarily talking about the very beginning, but somewhat after the very beginning, we have this. Now, there's an exegetical controversy going on here beyond that. This is often what the secular people worry about. They look at this and they say, wait a minute, these are advanced plants. This means that Genesis is wrong. No need to pay attention to the Bible. This is where we need to correct them and say, it looks like that in the English, but that's not the way it is in the original. If you want to nitpick this scientifically, it's important to look at what the original words actually mean and say. And recognizing that in the Hebrew language, we have an extreme paucity of nouns. So it really shouldn't come as any surprise to us that in biblical Hebrew you don't have a choice of a lot of words for describing these kinds of characteristics of the plants. You know, and almost half of the English language is in the arena of biological terms, biological and chemical terms. So we shouldn't be surprised that we have this translation difficulty. We're going from perhaps the poorest language in terms of vocabulary to describe plant structures into the richest language that's ever existed for describing plant structures. So we shouldn't be surprised that we got this problem going from Hebrew into English. But one that's of more common discussion amongst, say, seminary professors and seminary students would be focusing on the verb for produce. The verb there is dasha, and it literally means produce. I mean, you can look at it again in your word study guide here. You don't get a lot of insight as to what's really going on here. It's number 25 here, to bring forth, to sprout, to cause, to produce. We're going to see it again with reference to the charettes, and there are three different ways it could be taken. And this is how different seminary professors look at this. They say, well, produce. Who's doing the producing? That's really the question. The text doesn't tell you who's doing the producing. It says, let the land produce. All right? It comes from the land. We already knew that. I mean, the component or some kind of chaos theory that we don't understand. Is this what's going on here? Is it a combination of the two? Well, the correct answer is the text isn't going to help you on that one. The text could be saying that it's 100% divine, miraculous intervention that's responsible for all the plant species we see on Earth. You could also interpret the text as saying God just simply set up the physics and then natural processes arose to bring about all these plant species from the dirt to the soil. That's an acceptable interpretation of that text. It's not ruled out by that verb, dasha. Neither can you rule out the fact that it might be a combination of the two. You know, God has his hand in it, but the natural processes take part of the role as well. You say, well, could you give us a percentage? Is it 80% God, 20% natural process? I'd say anything from 0 to 100 fits in with what the text here is saying. It's not going to help you on this. Yes. Yeah, I caught that piece, and I hadn't had a chance to read it in detail, but that'd be an interesting spin on it. God spoke it into existence and maybe used some complex acoustical waves to work with the elements. That's how it happened. You know, there are ways the text could get more specific. The text could use the verb asa. We're going to see that verb come up. It hasn't shown up yet in the text. It's interesting that it's never appeared in a text to this point. That verb means to manufacture. Yes, Tony?
The word that the Greek Hebrew scholar chose to use here,
Septuagint,
is a word in biology that indicates an immature cell, something that can go off in a bunch of different directions, like blastocyte. It's almost like that word right here. You can produce a lot of different things from stem cells.
True. Well, that gets into the next topic at hand. What does the text mean by kinds? Okay, why don't you hold your thought till we get there, because that's another whole issue that's brought up in this text. Because it talks about these plants reproducing after their own kinds. What does that mean? That's another whole controversy. But we're going to save that controversy until we first put the lid on this one. What's this dasha all about? But we need to realize God had other options in giving this text to us. He could have stuck in the verb asa, which would have meant that God was 100% responsible for manufacturing these plants. Now, it wouldn't mean that he was producing them brand new, independent of the laws of physics. It would mean he would be using the laws of physics to construct it. That verb asa would be like, say, having Tom Leslie here go to the lumber yard, buy a bunch of lumber and pipes and wiring, and building a house. I mean, he went to the lumber yard and got the raw materials, but he was the one that constructed the house. And if that stuff were left in the lumber yard, no house would ever be built. I mean, you ever notice that? You go to the lumber yards, you look at the stuff there, it just sits there. Nothing much happens. If you wait long enough, it decays. It takes a Tom Leslie to take all that stuff and put it into a house that you can live in. This would be the verb asa. But Genesis does not use the verb asa here in the text. And it's appropriate to ask why. If God indeed was 100% responsible for personally constructing and manufacturing these creatures, these plant species, why doesn't the text use the verb asa? So that's one good question to ask. Yes?
I have
Verse 7?
I particularly noticed that because of verse
Ah, so God made the expanse. Yes, that is in there. That's the first time it shows up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he makes the sky. And I think I failed to bring that out last week because we were going through that whole business of this collision and how exquisitely it's got to be fine-tuned. That would justify the use of the verb asah in that text. Okay, because if it's just kind of let there be, you'd expect this big, heavy atmosphere. But evidently God got involved here, set up this collision, designed it very carefully, and this would justify the use of the verb asah there in the text. I failed to bring that out last week. I was running out of time, so I'm running out of time now, so I need to keep moving, yes. So thank you for bringing it up. That was a point I really wanted to get out last week and never got to, so thanks.
Yes. God does not do what he can possibly delegate to the humans, the creatures, or creation. So this might have an idea here. God starts it, but he delegates it. And even though this is inanimate, or it could be inanimate,
sure.
He lets it do it himself.
Well, the principle of economy here. And a lot of non-Christians bring this out about the Bible. That's one of the things we notice about the Bible. God practices the principle of economy. I think you've stated it very well. If he can delegate, he does.
And it goes so far as that, you know, he could do it instantly and perfectly, but he lets us blunder through it. You know? He lets us cooperate with what he wants to do.
Well, what I'm getting at here is that the fact that we have the verb dasha here rather than asa indicates that there is some role for the natural process. I don't think it's a total role. If it was a total role, then we expect to see haya. We don't see haya, we don't see asa. Asa would be 100% God. Haya would mean that God is working through the natural processes, delegating to the natural processes, but neither word is used. Right. So I think it's some of each, and this is kind of borne out when we look at what's going on in the world today. We do see new plant species appearing by natural processes. Not a lot, just a handful. Maybe Lynn can tell us how many show up every 10 years. I don't know, but it's a small number. But, you know, as we look at the world of nature, God is at rest today. He is not creating in the physical world like he was during the 6 days of creation. So the fact that we see a tiny amount of a new plant species coming to existence by natural process, that might be our justification here for the verb dasha. Because what's going on today through natural processes would be going on in the past. Physically, the world is not a lot different 3-4 billion years ago, 1 billion years ago, compared to what's going on today. So if we see a little bit of natural process going on, then we would expect it was going on before, and that might be the justification of dasha. But the fact that we can only measure a tiny amount of changes taking place through natural processes in the plant kingdom leads me to suggest that God is taking the primary role. I mean, you're not going to create life by natural processes. God's going to be responsible for that. But there might be some branching. That gets us into the discussion. What's going on with kinds? Let's look at that text again. It says, let the land produce vegetation, plants bearing seeds according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. Is that word for kinds to be interpreted as being species? Is it genera? Are we talking families? Are we talking orders? I mean, we bring Lynn up here, she would tell you that we can classify species of plants and animals according to narrow categories like species or broad categories like the orders. And, you know, where do Hebrew scholars fall in this? Again, I spent about a week looking into this and seeing everybody had written about this word men, and they've written a lot. And this goes back all the way to the early church fathers. This is a word everybody wants to know what it's all about. Well, let me just tell you where the scholars, the Hebrew scholars, fall on this. There are some who interpret it as referring to species. In other words, the text would permit changes only within a species. Every interpreter, by the way, interprets this word "men" as meaning that some change in plant life can take place under that kind. But how much change and to what extent? There's a small number that say it's species only. Changes can take place within a species, but you're not going to get a species changing into a new species. A much larger category of scholars say it's referring to the biological equivalent of the genera. In other words, this word would be referring to categories of species that are closely related to one another. And therefore, there would be room within that word for a species to change slightly into a new species as long as it falls within a particular genus. There are those who say a small number that it could extend to families and orders. What's interesting is who votes where. All right? The young Earth creationists want the largest possible expanse of change. So they say it refers to families and orders, not species and genera. And it's the old Earth creationists that say, well, it's probably genera. The most liberals are saying that it's species, and therefore the Bible is wrong. Okay, that's kind of where it's very interesting where people fall on this. Now, if you go into the ancient literature, it doesn't help you much because things like species, genera, families, and orders weren't even defined. We didn't know enough about biology even to comment on this stuff. But it is interesting that some early church fathers make the point that this word men would allow for a fairly broad category of animals rather than extremely narrow. Yes, Lynn.